playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. So, forget the Brexit roadshow, forget the broadband bid. The Ballybrack footballer who came back from the dead was the one making the headlines this week. Apparently, Ballybrack was due to play Arklow Town last Saturday, but were worried that they didn't have the numbers to field a team. So, a story was concocted that one of their players had died in a road accident, and that's when the big fat lie got out of hand. Fernando Lafuente Saeed spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday morning, claiming that reports of his death were greatly exaggerated.
You're the man at the centre of a very strange story in the last 12 hours or so. Ballybrack FC, a Dublin soccer club, has apologised for faking a player's death, your death, Fernando, in order to get a match called off. They claimed you'd been killed in a car crash on the way home from training. All of this just to avoid a match against Arklow last Saturday. Fernando, when did you first hear about all of this?
Well, I was aware there was going to be some story on me, but I thought it was going to be me breaking a leg or something like really seamless. But I was just today home after my work finished. I was playing some video games and suddenly I got a call from work and it was like, oh, what's happened? And they told me, like, you're a celebrity. And it was like, why is that? And they started sending me all these news articles and all this mass media. And that's how I found out that I was dead.
This was just last night you found out you were dead?
Yeah. I knew something was going on and they called me like, okay, Fernando, in case you see maybe the league post something on Twitter saying you had an accident, but I thought it was going to be like the breaking leg kind of accident.
And they said to do what? To ignore
that? Nothing. Just so I was warned on. I mean, I have a really good relation with them and they've taken care of me really good while I was there. So, I mean, just to let me know.
Yeah, and like, at what stage did anybody from the club get in touch and talk to you about what had actually happened, that they had reported your death in a car crash or a car accident?
As soon as I heard from the news, I wrote them and they got to me straight back and told me what was going on. They apologized and everything. So, I mean, it's serious on their part, but I mean, I'm finding it a little bit funny because basically I'm not dead and no one has actually been harmed here, so...
Were your family in Spain, were they hearing anything, Fernando?
My wife had some Facebook fuss, but she already knew everything. I had to call my mom straight away because she basically didn't knew anything of what was going on, etc.
Yeah.
And just I called her and she saw this morning all the... of my photo and the newspapers and everything, and I haven't spoken with her yet, but she didn't answer me back in any of the messages I sent. So
yes, but at least, as they say, rumours of your death are premature.
It was a story that ran all week, and of course it was a hot topic on The Gathering, with politicians Hildegard Nocton and Catherine Murphy and journalists John Downing and Hugh O'Connell.
From Ballybrack FC's point of view, it's not a very good thing that they did. I mean, there's been lots of gags around it. I heard that they were putting up black armbands on eBay that had only been used once and stuff like this, because obviously there was this moment of silence for him last weekend across the Football League, and it transpires that he's alive.
It'll be a heck of an attendance at his month's mind.
Yeah. I imagine the Leinster Senior League will be looking for a doctor's certification or something in future.
Exactly, yeah.
It started, apparently, according to Sean Dunne in the Mail yesterday, that there was a stag party or a stag trip, and they realised they were going to be short, that the stag party obviously wasn't going to be in Arklow.
Yeah, because the Leinster Senior League are pretty reasonable in terms of allowing a postponement, but not for something like, I'd say, a stag party. So that wouldn't have stacked up. But you would have to think at the club, you know, the heart and soul that people put into clubs like that and selling tickets and keeping the show on the road, that, look, you know, nobody died here, and I think let's learn
some lessons.
And could be Galway's gain, Ballybrack's loss?
Yes, he's now working in Galway, and I think it shows the power of social media as well. As my grandmother says, lies have no legs, and I think especially in a small country like this and where social media, you know,
it's a great opportunity for Ballybrack to get one of the undertakers to sponsor them.
Gas. It's like one of those mad sketches from the Tommy Tiernan playbook. Well, Tommy was actually Ray Darcy's guest on Thursday. He'll be hitting the road shortly with his new show, Paddy Crazy Horse, and he's just launched a new video called Under the Influence. So, apart from talking about drink and his wife Yvonne, his father who never comes to see his shows, he also spoke about the UNESCO decision to recognise the ancient game of hurling as a protected cultural activity which needs safeguarding.
Hurling, it seems to me, doesn't need any protection.
No.
At the moment, you know, I was thinking about the different nationalities that might be good at hurling around the world. I'd say the Israelis would be great at it. Don't you?
Why so?
Because it's pure Old Testament.
Right.
It's pure Samson, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Moses. I think the Presbyterians up north would take to it. There's enough anger in it to swing a stick at. The Balkans. Oh, by Jesus, I tell you, Srebrenica versus Bosnia live on Air Sports, it'd fly. The English wouldn't be any good at it, you know, not unless they were on a horse. The Mexicans would be great at it. The English would be good at it if they were on Mexicans. And the Australians wouldn't take to it. Why not, Tommy? I'll do the questions as well. Just go back to being conscious. Sorry, Ray, would you just drift off there for a second? You were looking at me, but it was like the toll booth in Enfield. There was, you should have a little sign.
No, I was letting you
off.
You're on a stream of consciousness there. I didn't want to interrupt.
I don't think hurling would take to Australia. I think they're too fond of themselves in Australia.
Right.
I think, and they're too good looking. There's a degree of self-loathing that you need in order to play the game well. So I don't think it would suit them. But I wouldn't say hurling needs any protection.
Did you play? I'm looking at your hands there, because you can usually tell a hurler's hands.
Crooked fingers. No, I was more of a pool player.
Right.
You can tell that by the smell of tobacco off my jacket.
You don't get many injuries playing pool.
No, you don't, no. But that was my game. Yeah. When I was growing up in Navan, playing in the Roundo and Fitzsimons' pub.
Tommy Tiernan with Ray Darcy on Thursday. It's 10 years now since Celine Cawley was violently killed by her husband Eamon Lillis at their home in Howth, County Dublin. He initially denied it, but he was eventually sentenced to just under 7 years in prison for her manslaughter. Celine ran a very successful film production business, and when her sister and brother, Susanna and Chris Cawley, both solicitors, were sorting out her financial affairs, they were shocked to discover that Celine's killer would get all of the couple's joint assets. Since then, they've been campaigning to have the law changed so that Celine's daughter could inherit from her mother's estate. Susanna and Chris Cawley were Marion Finucane's guests last Saturday.
Let's go back over. Your sister was very successful. She was a terrific businesswoman. There was a lot of property involved.
Yeah, so there was significant production business and retained cash in that business, and there was various savings and bank accounts, life policies. In addition to that, there were two houses held jointly in Ireland, good areas, so they were worth a lot of money at the time.
Yeah.
And then a house in France, also held jointly.
And under our laws, he could have inherited all that?
Oh, he was automatically entitled to it. Entitled to it. So we had to try and vary that.
So what did you get for your niece? 50-50?
100% of the French assets.
Oh, 100% yes. Of the French.
50% of the jointly held Irish assets. So he got the other 50%, plus he got what was already entitled to his, which we had never
contested.
You know, we'd never contested with regard to what he got out of the business in terms of retained earnings and other personal assets. So he was already in a very strong financial position.
Right. And came out to that.
Yes.
Yes. The difference between the French and the Irish is really very, very remarkable. Now, what you're worried about the new bill is, OK, 50-50 is painful, and you would prefer it was 100%. But 50-50 is something. But you think that the legislation may leave it to the discretion of the judge?
Yeah, there's in the current drafting, there is a suggestion that you'd have to look at the input into the 50% of that property. So that means more litigation. And for a lot of people, number one, there just isn't the value in the property and the value in the family home to take on High Court litigation at that level. And the stress that you're already suffering in terms of dealing with, you know, bereavement and all of that, then to add complicated, complex High Court litigation to it. Whereas what we're hoping is maybe that it would be more like an automatic disentitlement, a bit like at a much lesser inflammatory level. If they wanted to widen the M50 and your house is in the front, your front garden is in the M50, they have legislation that can
CPO it.
And we need to balance the public good with the legislation.
Yes.
Fighting a contested case in the High Court is extremely expensive, and legal fees in the case came to €187,000. But because there is law enacted in France, it was more procedural and cost €16,000, all of which came out of their niece's estate.
I was reading an old article this morning that was written by Kathy Sheridan, which was written after the whole case was over. And she was touching on narrative as well, and how Celine was painted essentially as a harridan.
Correct.
And it was only afterwards that her humanity and her fact that she's a mother, fact that she's a sister, fact that I gather she had a great sense of humour and all of those things. What was that like?
Yeah, well, it was horrific, really. I mean, the lack of dignity surrounding the fact that there's someone dead in all of this is very difficult, very hard to pallet. And, you know, even for someone who's used to court settings, you're absolutely powerless sitting there during a criminal trial. And what's being said, you can't contradict it. You have no voice. It's very difficult. But, you know, we know what Celine was like and her wonderful personality and her incredible generosity, and that didn't come across because the concentration was on the sordid details of the method of her passing and also what led up to that.
Yeah.
That was very difficult to sit through, and very difficult for my father in particular.
It must have been crucifying for him, really, because it's very hard to sit and listen to your daughter, who is now dead, having her character torn to shreds.
Yeah.
Susanna and Chris Coley with Marion Finucane. On Thursday, we heard from another grieving family and about another brutal attack. 45-year-old Cathal O'Sullivan was jailed for life for the murder of Nicola Collins, the mother of three children. In a victim impact statement, the Collins family said that the person portrayed in court was not their Nicola, and that the vile allegations they had to listen to left them feeling disturbed and embittered. Nicola's younger sister, Carly Collins, joined Sean O'Rourke yesterday to tell him the truth about her beautiful sister.
We weren't planning on speaking to media about anything, really, but it was just horrendous the way that she was portrayed in court. And, you know, as I said in the victim impact statement, she did have issues. She did struggle with alcohol, and that was the hard part, you know, that got completely blown out of proportion. She was turned into a monster, really. But she was absolutely beautiful. She was talented. You know, we loved her, of course. We had so much hope for her. And that was the hardest part, you know, that hope is gone.
And tell me a little bit more about what didn't come out in court, about the kind of person she was. Because, as you say, she was very funny. She made you all laugh easily.
Yeah, she was very funny. Her sense of humour was brilliant, and that'll be missed. She was very intelligent. She liked playing the piano when she was younger. She loved makeup and hair, and she was very into that kind of thing. And she wrote a lot. She did a lot of journaling, and she found it very therapeutic to put pen to paper.
And you've acknowledged this, that she had problems with anxiety and alcohol dependency. I mean, at what stage in life did they arise?
Relatively young, but I suppose it just got worse over the years. She had great moments, times where she was sober, but just around the time of March, she hadn't been doing very well, and this would put her at risk of meeting a person like this, unfortunately. And another thing is that I don't believe this person was actually her boyfriend, even though I think that was part of the story, that it corroborated his story, but we had never heard of him. Yeah.
And the other thing, at the end of the trial, it emerged that another woman, 3 years earlier, she was left severely injured by this man.
We did know about that, but obviously we weren't allowed to speak about that, but we knew of it, but we didn't know the extent of it, and that was very upsetting, hearing about that yesterday after the murder conviction was read out. I think everybody became so sad. And of course, you're just left thinking, how could things be different for both of them, and how could it have been different even if he had just gotten the sentence at that time?
Carly Collins heard on the Today Show yesterday. Well, earlier this week, the Fiscal Advisory Council criticised Budget 2019. The FAC is the independent body set up to assess government policy, and it warned that spending went beyond safe levels and left the country exposed in a downturn. Well, the matter was discussed on Wednesday's The Late Debate with Katie Hannan and her panel.
Can I refer you to a tweet from Kieran Ferry, who says, "Oh dear, Kieran O'Donnell has just said the fundamentals of the economy are very good."
He took the words out of my mouth.
Now, where have I heard that phrase before?
I did, because I like Kieran. See, I like Kieran. And as soon as he said that, I had the words in my mouth. Where have I heard that before? But I didn't want to say it. I was trying to be too nice.
I think people need to know the real Donald. This is a good guy.
Is the economy strong and stable?
Can I just say something, right?
Who knew you could have so much fun discussing the fiscal space? So, is the boom really getting boomier? A question Sean O'Rourke put to Fine Gael TD Hildegard Nocton and political commentator John Downing.
We're told that we're now closer to the next economic disaster than we were to the last one. And I think you don't have to be economically qualified to feel that kind of vibe in your bones. I think a lot of people have that fear. Hildegard harks back to Fine Gael's reputation for clearing up after Fianna Fáil excesses. But the other week in City West, I think I noticed Fine Gael moving into the Fianna Fáil space. New Fine Gael looking rather like old Fianna Fáil.
Not when you're heading for a balanced budget, setting up a rainy day fund. All of that is contingent on outside forces like Brexit and all of that. And Pascal Donoghue has been very clear on that.
I was just there noting that there are three, four potential shocks. One or other of them is definitely going to come home, but Brexit most likely, but interest rates, the Trump protectionism, the fragility of our dependence on multinational investments. So, I mean, we're at a turning point in our politics. The question is, would voters be prepared to go with a party or parties who'd say we'll keep things tight and avoid economic disaster? Or will they just go yet again for promises of largesse?
From the Today Show yesterday. It seemed the whole country was glued to the toy show last night with the all-singing, all-dancing Ryan Tubridy and gangs of happy kids. Over on Planet Callan's Kicks, they remembered the ghosts of toy shows past.
Lego City is the new craze, and reviewing this one is little Leo from Castleknock. How are you, sir?
Yeah, fine, whatever.
Look at all this mess here. You've had all this time and it's just a mess.
Yeah.
You haven't built a single Lego house.
Yeah, it was like that when I got here. Why don't I ask some of the POV kids what they've been doing?
Oh.
I've been reading third year books and I'm only in sixth class.
Well done. And what's in your Santa list?
What I want is a Thatcher poster, Thatcher biography and a lock of her hair. Because she's so cool and stuff.
Lovely,
wow.
Boys. Thank you.
Don't patronise me, Byrne. You're from Rialto. Gross.
Don't encourage him. Over here to our next reviewer, Mary Lou from Churchtown. What have we got for
us? Well, first of all, because I'm a girl, I was given terrible toys to review.
Oh, dear.
Fashion wheel, Spirograph.
Yes.
Give me a break.
And Baby Wee Wee, of course.
As if.
Well, why don't we give you Action Man here? He's armed and everything.
I don't want that one.
Well, now, it's a talking one. If I just press this here.
I did not interrupt you.
How about
it? I said I don't want it.
Okay, well done. Joining me now from the north side of Dublin.
Yeah, the pav side, more like.
Don't mind them, Pascal. Hello, Sonny.
Thank you very much for having me on the telly.
Now, what books did you like?
Well, this book here cost $12.99, so I didn't like that one.
Yes, but what was it about?
This book was way better. It was only £1.99. Very good value. And if you keep the sticker on it, you can read it and then leave it back and get your $1.99 back, so you can hoard the money and spend it only when you need votes.
Votes? You mean sweets?
No, I don't.
No.
I only have a certain amount of pocket money.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't be like that. It's time for the Super Soaker. Here we go.
Yeah,
we
water go. Cannon, the toy show audience, they're a disgrace. All they want is free stuff and they don't want to pay for anything. Typical POVs. Get them good, Gabo. Toy show cheats cheat us all.
I think it's your turn, little Leo.
What?
There we go.
Don't you dare. This is a brand new Canali suit. I'll get you for that. I'll be back and I'll run this whole country. You'll see. Private school boys will run everything, including the late late. Ha ha. You'll see. You'll all see. I'm going to wreck the gaff.
Come back to us after this. Hup, hup, hup. Hey, hey.
from Callan's Kicks last night. Well, Derek Mooney was minding the shop while Ryan Turbidy was off with the circus, and he had a lovely story on Thursday about a random act of kindness on the streets of New York City. Geraldine McKenna was on a trip to New York with her two daughters in October. They are fanatical about musicals and really wanted tickets to the hottest show on Broadway, Hamilton.
Anyway, walked around to Richard Rodgers Theatre one last time with the two of them and got to the top of the queue, and I said to the girl, any tickets for Hamilton? And she said, I'm just after getting three returns, just like that. So the three of us were ecstatic. So I said, great, I'll take them, thank you very much. And I started counting out my cash and realised I was $20 short.
No!
Yes, so I explained the story to the woman, listen, I have money in my hotel, can I go back to the hotel and I'll come back to the $20, you can hold on to the tickets. And she said, no, you've got 5 minutes to get the tickets. So I said, right, what am I going to do? And for some reason I started running towards Times Square with the two daughters running behind me and they're crying. I just think to myself, I'm going to ask an Irish person or something, or run into an Irish bar and explain the situation. But I didn't find an Irish bar, so I ran up to this cop in New York and I explained the situation, and he very kindly opened his wallet and handed me $20.
No way.
Yeah, I explained just the story. The two kids were crying. He handed me the $20 and off we went running to get the tickets. But when I was talking to him, I took his badge number and his name, which he didn't realise I did. So when I came home, I wrote him a thank you letter and returned the $20 and sent him €20 with it, that if he ever came to Ireland, he wouldn't be stuck. I got the address to send it to via Twitter. I contacted the NYPD on that and they told me I had to write to Mayor De Basso to get the letter to him. So I wrote a little note to Mayor De Basso and a letter to the officer in question, and I never thought another thing about it until I got an email from NYPD chief police officer saying that they had got my letter and he had received accommodation. And then only 2 weeks ago the NYPD contacted me again and said they wanted to put the story on Facebook, and since then it's kind of gone a bit nuts.
So you said to this cop, Ricardo,
you said
to him, listen, if you ever come to Ireland,
make sure you give us a shout if you ever stuck for anything in Ireland.
Well, I've news for you, he's in Ireland. He's in the studio right in front of me now.
He's not.
No, he's not. But he is on the telephone. Say hello to each other.
Hello.
Hello, Ricardo. How are you? Thank you so much for everything you did that day.
Anytime.
Tell me, Ricardo, you know, you do one good deed and a good deed comes back to you. Did anything good happen to you since?
Oh, sure. I mean, as soon as the story hit the internet, it exploded over here. And I got interviews from all these different magazines and it was crazy. I was like, oh, what is going on? It was nice. It was definitely, just helping people out, and that's what I do. You know, I'm in Times Square every day, and I deal with, you know, hundreds of people a day, and I just try and make everyone's experience in Times Square a good one.
New York City cop Ricardo De Candia and Geraldine McKenna with Derek Mooney on Thursday. Well, Brian O'Connell was also out on the beat this week with Gartha Paul Bainham. He was reporting from Limerick on a pilot initiative where Gardaíonn traffic units have been issued with smartphones. They're using apps to allow them access a whole range of data about drivers and vehicles at the roadside checkpoint.
Brian, I gather some people weren't quite as lucky and a number of vehicles actually ended up being seized.
Well, the first man that Gardaí came across was driving a van from Dublin to Limerick. He was delivering Christmas trees and wreaths and a tax disc was clearly out of date on the windscreen. He was actually driving for someone and he was convinced that the tax and the insurance had been paid, but the smartphone app didn't confirm the details that he was given to Gardaí. I suppose, Sean, I have to say, the thing I admired about this fella was just how good-humoured and relaxed he was throughout the encounter. I joined the interaction here just after Gardaí told this man that he's likely to have to spend a night in Limerick because they were going to seize his van.
Are they having a sleepover?
It looks like you're down here for the night, maybe.
Yeah.
Is he after getting a half day?
He's after getting, yeah.
You taking the van?
The only problem is you're going to have to find your way back to Dublin.
Where will you stay tonight if you have to stay in Limerick?
I won't be staying in Limerick. I'll be getting my way back home. Someone will be picking me up.
So obviously you spoke to the boss on the phone.
Spoke to the boss. The boss told me that the vehicle was taxed and he taxed it a couple of weeks ago. But through the app I was able to check that the tax hadn't been taken out of the vehicle.
So what will happen now?
The vehicle will be seized under Section 41 of the Road Traffic Act.
And he's a load of Christmas trees, I think, in the back of it. Is he likely to be able to deliver them for Christmas?
Depending how fast he can get his tax insurance, I suppose. You were speaking to your boss, were you?
No, he's ringing me here now. Do we have bunk beds in the station?
Depends how much you upset me, I suppose.
So you're taking this, yeah?
Yeah.
It's not going to be happy. You're a grey owl, Santy, aren't you? Uh-huh. We'll see what he says now when I ring him.
What do you make of these apps that they're using?
I thought he was going to ring someone there. I says, Dan, who app? He says,
you thought he was calling for backup?
Yeah, he said, you get the big guns out, you're in trouble. We pulled out the new phone and worked away on it, and everything came up on the vehicle straight away. It was quicker, makes things faster, but you wouldn't expect them to be out in the rain. It must be the door here.
Brian O'Connell reporting on the new Garda app. But of course, there's always some wag monitoring proceedings on the airwaves.
Wayne has texted in to say, good luck with that new Garda app. For once, us country folk might have one over on the city folk with the lack of internet 4G coverage down the country. Yeah. The technology won't work in a lot of areas and we'd get away with it in our cars now.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. The Oscar-nominated costume designer Consolata Boyle has over 60 movies to her credit and is much in demand. Her love affair with cinema began while working in the fledgling Irish film industry in the 70s. Well, these days, she spends about 9 months of the year working abroad.
So you do that level of research on all your characters, do you?
Yes, I do, because I think it's very important to come... Even if you're familiar with a topic or a character, you need to start completely with a blank page and try to bring no preconceived ideas with you and start the kind of investigation from absolute scratch. I think that's the best way of doing it.
And would you run all that past the director?
I think the whole thing is communication with the director to know what is the point of view we're coming from? What story are we telling? What
is
this about?
And that is all reflected in the clothes.
Completely. The clothes are, in a way, the servant to the story. And they need to express that the inner life. And before an actor has opened their mouth with a line of dialogue, you can tell so much about them from what's on their back.
Whether they're well off, whether they're poor.
Their history, their state of distress or non-distress, everything. And obviously the clothes follow sometimes they can be beautiful, sometimes they can be ugly. So they're completely dictated by the life of that character.
Right. Meryl Streep, wasn't it Meryl Streep that you had to do so many costumes and costume changes that you ended up, the two of you, in Fitzel after all?
Yeah, that particular character, that tragic character.
I don't know if I gave her full name. It was Florence Foster Jenkins.
That's right. And the thing about the clothes, she had like almost like a dressing up box mentality to her clothes. So there was non-stop accessories, frocks, everything. And Meryl was hugely good-humoured about it and we laughed a lot.
Well, that's always good, isn't it? And she gave you a rather nice...
Yeah, she did this incredible... She actually was trained as a costume designer, Meryl, as part of it. So she's always loved costume and is wonderful to work with. And she can draw. And she gave me this beautiful little cartoon framed in this fussy little frame, perfect for Florence, with her standing there looking at this rail of clothes saying, oh, please, something simple, Consolata. And I adore it and I treasure it.
Costume designer Consolata Boyle in conversation with Marion Finucan. The folklorist, artist and musician Dr. Billy McGlynn is also passionate about the power and beauty of costume, masks and ritual. He's the curator of the performance project Pagan Rave, which takes place in Dingle this weekend as part of the Ireland's Edge Festival. Billy McGlynn was Sean Rock's guest on Tuesday.
What is involved in a pagan rave, Billy?
It's different things at different times, but at times it can be very small amount of performers wearing masks and things like that, playing instruments that we specially craft for the event. And then sometimes we have very big events with upwards of 70 people performing and over 1,000 people participating. As audience, we would light fires, we would have music, specific movements, all of these kind of things to sort of invoke an otherworldly sense, I suppose. I tend to look for inspiration from folk traditions from throughout Europe and indeed from our own folk traditions as well. And I use those as sort of building blocks and ideas, and we use them as a sort of creative, imaginative project that devise those kind of rituals.
Anything significant in the particular time of year that you've chosen for this festival? You know, we're in the depths of midwinter. Are you picking up on perhaps pagan and pre-Christian rituals there?
Yeah, I suppose early December would be close enough to the winter solstice, and you're never that far away from one of the ancient festivals. You're only ever about 6 weeks away from one of them. But we see throughout a lot of different cultures the depths of winter where people would be at their lowest and there would be the least amount of light, that you see a lot of festivals of light and celebrations of life. life and renewal and things like that. So Christmas, I suppose, is the most common of the modern manifestation of that. But the winter solstice, you know, and things like Newgrange would have all been times when those kinds of events would have been celebrated. So we would be looking to how they might have celebrated that in the past in a sort of an imaginative sense.
From Tuesday night's arena. Well, I gather there was no pagan rave, just good old-fashioned rock and roll style when Pogue singer-songwriter Shane McGowan married the love of his life, Victoria Mary Clark, in magical Copenhagen last Monday. The couple have been together for over 30 years and got engaged 11 years ago.
Victoria Mary Clark, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Ryan.
It was one of those, was it? Well, congratulations first and foremost to yourself and Shane. The papers are full of your gorgeous wedding photos this morning. How do you feel this morning? All horsiness aside.
Well, I'm really like kind of surprised that people are so interested, to be honest.
Well, it was only 32 years in the waiting, so probably people were just wondering, would it ever happen? How was the day out?
It was actually so beautiful. I couldn't have imagined it being more beautiful. I know that sounds like really corny.
No, it's nice. That's what it's meant to be. And what sort of ceremony did you have? Or tell us a little bit about the day.
Well, it was actually like, you know, a Danish civil ceremony done by the registrar in the city hall. But the city hall in Copenhagen is one of those enormous medieval type buildings, like a Gothic kind of palace. So it was quite an interesting location.
Yeah.
And she was really nice. Like, she, you know, she said, make sure you always laugh together. Make sure you always have a sense of humor, stuff like that, which I can't imagine a priest saying to you.
And why did you go for Copenhagen rather than Ireland or anywhere else?
Well, I just kind of like it there. It's really beautiful, especially in the winter, because they've got this thing called the Tivoli Garden. It's like the oldest fun fair in the world.
Beautiful.
And it's full of Christmas trees and snowmen and snow, and you know, it's really pretty.
And I'm dying to know about the music. Who was singing and who was playing?
Well, Johnny Depp. He tried to do Rainy Night in Soho, but Shane stopped him. He said, "Stop doing that! I don't want to hear that." So then he did Astral Weeks, which was absolutely gorgeous. It was fantastic.
God. Did you have a go at a song yourself, Victoria?
I couldn't even speak. Like, I'm doing really well now, but yesterday I couldn't talk at all.
And
I couldn't do a speech. We all did speeches, except me. I had to do a dance instead of a speech.
Oh, why not? And what sort of things was Shane saying? Was he very romantic yesterday?
Like, no, not really. He was his usual self. He hasn't changed at all.
That's why you're still together. That's why you're still together. Yeah.
Bridal beauty Victoria Mary Clark with Ryan Tubridy the morning after the night before. A diagnosis of Alzheimer's would likely strike dread into most people, but Des O'Grady, a Jesuit priest who was diagnosed with the illness 5 years ago, is walking, talking, living proof of living well with Alzheimer's. So much so that he features as one of the elder wisdom figures from around the world in a new book, Sharing the Wisdom of Time, by Pope Francis. Des was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Thursday, and as well as speaking about the challenges of his condition, he also explained how, as chaplain in the Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum, he put his wisdom to work when saying Mass became a problem.
Because I was the only priest available in the Central Mental Hospital, which was my last job as chaplain there, I trained one of the patients, who was very happy to do it, to accompany me. He had another copy of the text, mm-hmm. and I had mine, and any time I'd get stuck, he would give me his copy, a little mark on it, and I continued on. And when I got stuck again, I'd pass it back, and he'd give me the other one back again.
So that you were able to thread your way through the sequences and not lose your place, or at least if you felt you were losing it, he would come along.
And, you know, after a week or two, we both knew our roles very well, and it just worked like clockwork. Mm.
Do you still feel hopeful about life?
Oh, good Lord, I mean, the heavens are still there. My friends are still there.
And are you able to get out and about much?
Oh, absolutely. Don't be disturbed by the stick. I've just twisted my ankle.
Okay,
I can still walk. Not the way I used to when I was 30 years old or anything like that.
And are you able to venture out on your own now still?
Oh, I do. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have no fear about going out on my own. And no one has any fear about letting me out on my own.
And would it concern you that maybe the day might come when that mightn't be possible? There'd be somebody will say to you, look, Des, do you know what?
for everybody's sake, for your own and for those of us who care for you,
yeah,
you'll have to be accompanied from now on.
I'll be fighting that day. I think I'll be saying to someone, it's for your sake. You don't want to be worrying about me. I don't want to be tied down.
Mm.
I'm still quite confident and willing to take the risk.
Feisty, as well as wise, a great combo. Father Des O'Grady, heard on the Today Show on Thursday. Natalia O'Flaherty is only 18, but already she's appeared on The Late Late Show with a spoken word piece specially commissioned by RTE called Not Like Other Girls. Well, such was the reaction. Ryan invited her onto his radio show the following Monday morning.
Spoken word, I mean, we say poetry versus spoken word. Is there a difference in terms of categorisation or does it matter?
Well, I mean, I'd say I'm a poet and I'd say I'm a spoken word artist and it's one and the same. I suppose when you say poet, people think more traditional.
I wandered lonely as a cloud. You know, you do think that, don't you, with poetry?
Yeah, you think of all like the classics and Leaving Cert poetry in particular. Oh, good luck.
Did you like poetry in school?
Yeah,
that's bad. School. That's ghastly.
Hated it. Like, I really enjoy poetry when I'm reading it for myself, but the way we had to break things down and analyse things and he meant this and he meant this, I was like, I never really bought into it, you know what I mean? Yeah. Probably true, probably exactly what they meant, but I just couldn't. I hate having to tear things apart to understand them. That's why I try and make my writing so like accessible without dumbing it down, you know what I mean? I just want people to get the message. And that's what spoken word is different, because it's you're speaking it, people are listening to it, taking it in right away. So that's why I try to make it a bit different.
When I saw your piece first and it was brought to my attention, I was just frozen to the spot. I was so impressed because your command of the language is so, as I say, impressive. But that's one thing to have a great vocabulary, but to put it together the way you do. And for people who didn't hear, I think it's important. I'm going to play a clip from Not Like Other Girls now, just to put you in a context. There's a little flavour of it. Obviously, it shouldn't be a flavour. It should be the whole thing, but just time wouldn't permit. How would you describe it? I was calling it like a manifesto for a generation of young women. No, but really, it feels like that.
No, I know what you mean. It's more of like a general message on how I feel, because it's very easy to be victimised as a woman and to put yourself in that box and say, oh, I'm a woman and I'm oppressed because of it. It's not wrong. That's not incorrect to say, but it's also the wrong narrative to have. And it's the whole pitting yourself against other women. It's a dangerous thing and it's a harmful thing. So this is a message to say you don't have to be what you're expected to be, but you can be that as well. You know what I mean? It's basically do what you want. Like you're a grand old girl. Do what you want.
I never liked pink or glitter or bows. Instead, I chose blue and dirt and digging. Never liked lipsticks or perfumes, never hung horse-themed posters in my bedrooms, assumed I was not like the other girls, and the other girls were not like me. I shied away from my femininity, maximised my masculinity so that the boys wouldn't pick me last in team chasing, bracing myself on my mark for racing, lacing up my football boots and booting it up and down the green, working 10 times harder to be part of the team.
She's great. Natalia O'Flaherty heard on the Tuberty Show last Monday. The poetry programme brought us back to the sunny days of July with the programme recorded at Derrynan House in County Kerry. Olivia O'Leary asked poet Fiona Rourke about the delicate matter of writing poems about her children.
When you write poems about your children, do they like it? Do they give out to you?
They don't give out to me. The poems I wrote for them when they were younger, they like. I'm not saying they would read them or encounter them very often. In fact, something that they both admitted to me, which is that they've never read a book either by me or their father, who's also a writer. They've never read anything that we've written. The absolute scuts. But maybe that's good, because it gives me great freedom. I can write anything about them. And in the last book, X, I had a poem for my daughter and I showed it to her, because obviously at this stage, you know, you'd have to get permission before you can write it, but before you publish it, you'd have to ask. And it has a line in it that says, she has so much beauty in her, and she didn't even go further than that. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, here's one poem Vona wrote for her son, Tommy, when he was about 4. He's not 4 anymore. He's a big fella.
Maize for Tommy. The Faber-Castells ripen in your hand. You've been drawing since breakfast, sky after sky, face after face, but something in yours says they're not quite right. Every fresh character is dipped in your range of skins, beige, primrose, lemon, sand, and still found wanting. You finally settle on maize, but not before almost a sheaf of paper has been scorched with a repertoire of possible flesh. The pages rustle into place. I'm watching you, and every irreproachable off-tone face is your own in the back of our first white polo when summer landed you, wide-eyed, at the door. Your head then was marooned in arrival, like our papier-mâché moon. See how you've given it petals, wings, hair I can run my hand through, the way the wind cross hatches an open field where corn is sweetening in its corn-silk skin, where yellow falters, gold begins to maize.
Vona Grourke, and the poetry programme is back tomorrow night at 7:30 when Olivia meets our laureate Nanogue, Sarah Crossan. How much is that doggy in the window? Is this real life? Is this just fantasy? Well, these are the questions posed in popular songs. But have you ever wondered what the answers are? Well, investigative journalist James Ball has been fact-checking for us, and he's just written a book with the answers. He joined Ray Darcy on Wednesday.
I normally work as a kind of investigative and data journalist, you know, on offshore leaks and the Panama Papers and the Snowden stuff. So this was a bit of a different use for those skills.
Yeah, completely different, but probably a great break.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot nicer to be checking, you know, whether this burning's an eternal flame versus, you know, whether someone committed war crimes.
OK, this is a lovely song and any excuse to play the voice of Karen Carpenter.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near, just like me?
Why do birds suddenly appear, James?
Well, it turns out whoever she's singing that to is just a really good bird expert. Because it turns out bird migration is really, really predictable. Like, they don't have access to a calendar or anything, but they tend to. You know, when they do these big transatlantic migrations, they sort of land within the same 1 or 2 day window every year. And so clearly whoever she's meeting is just really good at saying, hey, look, all these birds turn up whenever I'm here. But it might be getting worse for him. You know, climate change, they're getting a bit more unpredictable. Yeah. So maybe one day soon she's going to turn up and he'll be there without all the birds.
And they're not all questions in the book. You do 87 songs. But you take lyrics of a song and you say, well, what would happen if you did that? For example, this one.
Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cry it.
So, could anybody cry anybody a river?
Yeah, no, I think he's talking BS on this one, I'm afraid. So, I looked at the average volume of a human tear in a medical journal, because this book is horribly over-researched, and it's 0.06 mil. And I then looked at the flow of the River Thames, which is 66,000 litres every second.
Yeah.
So if you want to cry the Thames, which is a pretty slow river, there's way, way many faster than it, you'd need 5.3 billion people crying from both eyes.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't think he cried her a river.
James Ball heard on the Ray Darcy Show on Wednesday. But I leave you now with a song from Keela, who celebrated 30 years of music making on Arena last Monday night. Gurmahag avasr goluder, tasulam gurwanshiv saltasaglar, agus gemeshiv lam taka anamakena, antachtin shahagin, gijishin, gijeshib slan.